Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week we pick a new history book that we find particularly interesting, and we interview the author of that book. This week I'm happy to say we have Aram Goodsusian on the show, and we'll be talking about his new book, King of the Court, Bill Russell and the Basketball Revolution. Bill Russell was the first African-American star of professional basketball, and he was completely dominant in his time. He was certainly the best basketball player to ever have stepped on the floor when he played in the NBA in the late 50s, and all the way through the late 60s, he played on the greatest franchise in the history of the NBA, that being the Celtics of, again, the late 50s and early 60s. He was also a very complicated character. It was difficult to be a black star at the time. People didn't really know how to do it. And Russell himself was a conflicted personality. He strongly felt the racism of the day. He also had tremendous personal ambition, and he also had personal demons that he wrestled with. And this made for a very interesting life in both professional sports and in the public arena, because Russell, late in his career, became kind of a public intellectual. It's a really fascinating life, and it tells us a lot about American culture, about the civil rights movement, about what it means to be a professional athlete in the United States, about fame, about lots of things, and Aram does a terrific job of telling the tale. So, without further ado, here is the interview. Hi, Aram.
Hi, Marshall.
How are you today?
I'm good, thanks. Thanks for having
good.
Me.
Good. I'm glad to hear it. I should tell our listeners that we have Aram Goodsusian on the show today, and we'll be talking about his new book, King of the Court, Bill Russell and the Basketball Revolution. I played basketball in, let's just say I played for many, many years, and I didn't really know a lot about Bill Russell, to be honest with you, because I grew up thinking that Magic Johnson and Larry Bird really were the people that you should consider the greatest basketball players of all time, but Aram has convinced me that it was, in fact, Bill Russell who dominated like nobody before him. And in a very interesting time, he, of course, was an African-American, and in a time in which being an African-American was a conflicted and complicated thing, and this is also a major theme of the book, but the book also is full of really terrific game narratives, if you like that kind of thing, and I do, and it reminded me of some games that I'd seen and heard about, so it was a terrific read, and I congratulate Aram for having written the book. Why don't you begin the interview for us, Aram, by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I teach history at the University of Memphis. I've been here now for just over 6 years, and I teach courses in African-American history, modern U.S. history, cultural history, and I taught a course on the black athlete in American history, which I started teaching just as I was researching this book. And teaching that class was actually a really good experience for helping me sort of sharpen a lot of my ideas about what the meaning of sport is in the African-American experience, and trying to see sport both as a vehicle for progress, as it's historically been known, but also as a reflection of the society's larger inequalities based on race. And Russell, of course, was a man who was wrestling with that throughout his life.
Mm-hmm. And I have to ask this. I'm sorry. It may seem inappropriate. Do you play basketball?
I have played on and off throughout my life. Just pick up. I never played in organized.
It's funny because
quite poorly. I was a competitive soccer player for most of my life. So really informed how I thought about sports.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, reading the book, it sounds like you've played your whole life. I can tell you that. you really know a lot about the game. So, why don't we begin by just telling Russell's story and the story of professional basketball in the United States and the world. And let's actually begin at the very beginning. How is basketball invented? Because it was one of these invented sports.
Yeah. In the first chapter of the book, I try to deal as sort of a digression from Russell's life when he starts to play basketball into the history of basketball itself. And it's invented in the late 19th century. And it is literally invented by James Naismith in the 1890s. And it's very much part of sort of the progressive notion of sport. It's a sport that he invents with the idea of almost a form of social control, and mixing with ideas of muscular Christianity, the notions that the basketball can be a way to discipline athletes, to keep them active but not hurt over the course of the winter months. He tries to write the rules to limit physical contact. But almost immediately, the sport goes totally beyond his objectives. People start playing it throughout the country. It becomes a phenomenon. It spreads through YMCAs and through schools, and people start to innovate in ways that Naismith never imagined. They start to dribble the ball. The game is at a faster pace. People just change the way that it's played. And so it's a sport that's in constant evolution over the course of the 20th century. So when Russell first starts playing in the 1940s in Oakland, California, he's playing a game that's already in this state of constant flux, and at a time when African Americans are starting to play the sport in large numbers, a function of the Great Migration, a function of African Americans migrating to northern urban centers. Because basketball is historically the city game, as it's known. Whatever ethnic group has populated American cities has typically flourished in basketball. Basketball is known as the Jewish game in the 1920s and the 1930s.
So let's talk about Russell himself then. And let's talk about the organization of professional basketball, because it did start as an effort to provide people with something to play during the winter months, we being in the Northern Hemisphere and so on and so forth. So we needed to play something indoors, and basketball turned out to be it. How did professional basketball start?
Well, professional basketball started as pretty much barnstorming. It was touring teams that would travel around. And professional basketball was always sort of a second cousin to college basketball, which had stable crowds and particular fan bases and was seen as sort of the more legitimate aspect of basketball. Pro basketball had sort of a shady reputation, if you will, through the 20s and the 30s and the 40s. And the most famous teams were the teams that traveled from place to place, the Philadelphia Soars, the Harlem Globetrotters, the original Celtics, who were based out of New York. But they were traveling teams, essentially, and they were constantly changing their rosters. They played all sorts of teams. Basketball didn't really have an established pro league until the forerunners of the NBA, which was the Basketball Association of America, which started in the late 40s. Basically, it was the BAA started because a group of owners of hockey teams, who also controlled arenas, had these arenas that were sitting dark whenever there wasn't a hockey game, and they were losing money. So they knew that some people played basketball. They knew that it had a little base of support, and they saw the popularity of the college game. So they tried to horn in on that. They tried to, most of them knew nothing about basketball. In fact, the first commissioner of the Basketball Association of America, who later became the first commissioner of the NBA, was a guy named Maurice Podoloff. And when he became the commissioner of the BAA, he had never seen a basketball game in the playoffs.
Pretty, that's rich. That's rich. Then the college game was already well established, and the professional game was in its infancy. Let me ask just one more question about these barnstorming teams. Were they integrated at the time, or were they segregated, and how exactly did that work?
They were mostly segregated. The two great African-American barnstorming teams, one was the Harlem Globetrotters, and the other was a team called the Harlem Wrens, which was short for the Renaissance Five. And these were the two most prominent African-American teams. And the Wrens were really the great team, especially of the 1930s. The Globetrotters were becoming more and more visible and well-known, not just for their basketball talents by the 1940s, but also because they had started entertainment routines, essentially what the Globetrotters are known for now, you know, the clowning and the gags. Mm-hmm. But in the 40s and 50s, they combined that with very high-level basketball. For most African-Americans entering the pros in the late 40s and early 50s, it was assumed that they would play, if they were one of the best players, it was assumed that they would play for the Globetrotters, mm-hmm. not try to enter into the professional ranks.
I see. So let's talk about Russell then. Where is Russell from? How did he grow up? What kind of circumstances is he from? And how does his own experience mirror that of many African-Americans in the mid-20th century?
Right. Well, as I mentioned a little bit before, Russell's family participated in this great migration. He grew up in West Monroe, Louisiana. His father worked in a paper bag factory. And this was a sort of half rural, half urban area that he lived in. But at the age of nine, it was during World War II, his family migrated to Oakland, California for the opportunities that were available in shipbuilding industry in particular during World War II in the Bay Area. And his parents found jobs there. Probably the most important aspect of Russell's early development, besides migration, was that his mother passed away when he was 8 years old. And Russell and his older brother were raised by his father. And this shaped him, I think, in two particular ways. One was that, you know, he was always, for the rest of his life, trying to protect himself against loss. He took a lot of comfort in a team and in a family and in personal and close personal relationships, but was also didn't let other people pass that shell because he didn't want to sacrifice that. He didn't want to see the threat of losing them as a result. The other big way I think that shaped him was that it gave his, by his father taking control of the household and raising him and his brother by himself, it gave him a model of manhood. It gave him a model of responsibility and integrity that was very important in terms of how he saw himself and in terms of how he saw his responsibilities when he entered into a public arena, not just in his private life, but in his public life.
So he actually grows up in Oakland, though, is that right?
That's correct. Yes.
Yeah, he grows up
for his from the age of 9 on.
Yeah, and you have some actually. One of the fascinating things about his athletic life, at least from my perspective, had kind of grown up in an athletic context, is, you know, I won't be specific about the players that I knew in junior high and high school, who I already knew were going to be great college athletes. But it wasn't clear at all about Russell in high school that he was going to be a great anything, was it? I mean, he was. Mm-hmm. Why don't you talk a little bit about, that's truly astounding. Why don't you talk a little about his athletic career? And I put career in air quotes in high school.
he got cut from his JV team when he was a sophomore, only by the good graces of the coach who sort of took a liking to him, did he get to sort of sit on the end of the bench of the JV team. And he didn't play for the varsity until his senior year, and he graduated on the half year. He had started his high school career in January, so he graduated in January as well, which means that he missed the end of his team season. So when at the end of the year, his team won the city championship, but they did it without him. Mm-hmm. So he wasn't a particularly great player by the time he had graduated high school. And I think that had an important effect on him in terms of his later life, in the sense that basketball never defined him. He never considered it the central part of his life in the way that for many young athletes who were great athletes from the time that they're young, basketball becomes the central element in their life. And that wasn't the case with Russell. He saw himself as a more of a total person. He was very introspective, very shy, immersed himself in books. His favorite thing was to go to the public library when he was a kid and to pore over art books by Da Vinci and others. So he's very different than your typical athlete. The only way that he got a college scholarship was that after he had finished high school in January of 1952, he got an offer to participate on this touring team. And since he was from the city's most established school for basketball, McClyman High School, and because he was the only person who was graduating on the half year, the person who was organizing this tour asked him to come. And it's there where he sort of finally put it together. He realized, you know, his coordination was developing, and he started to understand basketball not just as an athletic endeavor, but as an intellectual endeavor. He started to really study the game and to understand the ways that he could innovate, the ways that he could reshape the game. Part of what he did was that he went against established basketball wisdom, and this was part of the reason for his greatness. Mm-hmm. In the 1950s, I read a bunch of basketball manuals from the time, coaching manuals and whatnot. They all tell the same thing. They all tell you the same thing. Never leave your feet on defense. And Russell realizes that he can jump to block shots. He has long arms, great leaping ability, exceptional timing. And he starts figuring out when he should be jumping to block shots, which was something that people just didn't do. And it explains his success. It explains how he really started to dominate the game in a new way. He innovated on defense at a time when everyone else was focused on offense. And he essentially took away the easy layup out of the game once he perfected how this was done. So when he got to college, he went to the University of San Francisco. By his freshman year, it was clear that he'd gone through this epiphany, if you will, in terms of understanding how to play basketball that turned him into very quickly a dominant player.
Mm-hmm. Did people say at the time about this jumping on defense, that is the shot blocking, did they say that this was somehow illegitimate or something?
Even his own coach, Phil Wolpert, who coached him at University of San Francisco and was as open-minded, as racially liberal, as innovative a coach as existed at the time. When Russell first started leaping to block shots in games, he would chastise Russell for doing this. He would say this was that's not the way that you play defense. And this sort of led to some of Russell's resentment festering against his coach and the university, that he felt like his gifts were unappreciated, even as he was driving them toward greatness. In his junior and senior year, Russell's team won the NCAA championship. And they were basically basketball unknowns before this time. But they went on a 55-game winning streak between his junior and his senior years, and two consecutive NCAA titles.
And were there many African-American players in college at the time?
No. In the West Coast, it was maybe under 10% of the college basketball teams. Of under 10% of the players on college basketball teams were African-American. Only two teams in the nation started three basketball players in Russell's junior year, and that was University of San Francisco, the team that he played for, and UCLA, which was another excellent team. Mm-hmm. Both schools had one or two black athletes, and typically they were stars because they would reserve spots on their roster only for the best of the African-American.
Mm-hmm. We should also say, I mean, Russell undergoes a tremendous physical transformation between the time he was roughly 15 and the time he's 20. I mean, he grew something like 10 inches or something, didn't he? I mean, I think you say in the book, one year he grew 4 inches.
Yeah, in his senior year of high school, he really sprouts.
Yeah.
By the time he graduates high school or starts at USF, he's close to, he's maybe about 6'8 by then, but he shoots up. He goes from being, at the same time, luckily for him, he finds his coordination. He was very gangly and awkward when he was a 7th grader, 8th grader, 9th grader. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I've got to think it's got to hurt, almost hurt to grow 4 inches in 1 year. I mean, that's got to be a painful process. I know I have young kids at home and they're growing pretty fast, but still, that sounds really, really, I mean, I'm tall and ungainly, and I can tell you that in those years, you can hardly find your feet. But yeah, he did incredible things. He was also, I mean, one of the things you mentioned in the book, and I think this is important to say, is that he brought a level of athleticism to the game. And we, you know, I want to avoid the stereotype about African Americans and athleticism, but this guy, you know, even among people who are great athletes, was a great athlete. He could do lots of things that that other people couldn't do. Like you mentioned, that he's a high jumper and he has this really strange style, but still he's great at it.
So, in college, he was a champion high jumper. A lot of people thought that he would be the first person to break the 7-foot barrier in high jumping. And he probably could have done it if he gave it any practice whatsoever. He literally never practiced it. He would just show up at the meets, do this sort of awkward front flop over, and jump 6'8", 6'9", which is, you know, really speaks to an incredible leaping ability.
Yeah. I mean, I think that one of the things that he did was he convinced people that you could be both big and very athletic and graceful, because it's kind of counterintuitive that these things can go together, because usually you see big people and they're kind of lumbering. But if you see someone like Russell, I mean, I've had the opportunity to play against some awfully large people who are fast and strong and jump very well and just basically do everything better than I can do it, even though they're much bigger. And, you know, this kind of body type and this notion that there are these people out there who can be 6'9" and weigh 225 or 230 pounds and be really fast and jump really well and be tremendously coordinated, you just don't find those people that often, but they exist. And he was really the first one, I think, to play basketball. Because if you think about someone like – I'm thinking of George Mikan, who was a great player, but he really was lumbering. Mm-hmm. He was a huge lumbering guy. But he was no Russell. I mean, he didn't, you know, he wasn't as fast or as strong, couldn't jump as well, and he couldn't shoot as well, and he couldn't do any of those things as well. So, yeah, I mean, I think Russell really is a kind of revolution in the sense that people are understanding that there are these people out there that can do all of these things at once. And, you know, he was sort of the first of them. So let's get him. I want to talk a little bit about his college career. What happened when a team like USF, even as famous and great as they were, what happened when they toured in the, they had to play in the South?
Well, they only visited the South and the actual South once, and that was when they went to play a game against Xavier University in New Orleans, basically because it was another Jesuit institution, and it was a Jesuit institution that was trying to build racial goodwill. It was sort of in this liberal Catholic tradition, and they had tried to integrate their seating at the games that year, and to try to play against teams which had African-American athletes. So So this was the one time when University of San Francisco, they went on this long national tour over there, winter break in Russell's senior season, and part of it went to Xavier. And Russell was sort of, he was torn. He was, it's his home state, of course, and part of him was very resentful of the prejudices and the segregation that he had to endure, as you might imagine. The rest of his teammates stayed at a downtown hotel, but he and his black teammates had to stay at the dorms at a nearby black institution. And then during the game, they were heckled and so on. And even the ref, he thought, mocked him based on his race. Yet at the same time, Russell in the 50s and maybe even into the early 60s was very conscious of his role as sort of a image ambassador, sort of the notion that had been carried on by people like Joe Louis and Jesse Owens and Jackie Robinson, the notion that black athletes have to be, to use the term that was used with Louis a lot, a credit to their race. They have to be seen as humble and dignified and foster racial goodwill themselves. So Russell was very conscious of this, and he tried very hard to restrain himself. But he's kind of stored all the resentments from trips such as this one inside him. Mm-hmm.
I'm glad you mentioned the word resentment, because it comes up again and again in Russell's life. And even in college, he has a conflicted relationship with his, by the lights of the times, very liberal coach, who also sounds like an interesting mm-hmm. figure. Maybe you could talk just a little bit about that.
Sure. Phil Wolpert, who's his coach at University of San Francisco, as I mentioned, is probably as liberal and as open-minded a coach as existed in the 1950s. Here's a guy who was breaking taboos by starting three blacks and sometimes playing four blacks on the court at the same time. This was just something that wasn't done in the 1950s in Big Ten college basketball. And Russell recognizes that. But at the same time, he feels like Wolpert never pumped him up, never promoted him to the press, that he didn't fully appreciate what Russell brought to the team. From Wolpert's standpoint, he saw this proud, very enthusiastic guy, and he figured that he didn't need any extra reinforcement. But for Russell, underneath that was that sensitive kid who'd lost his mom when he was 12 years old, who wanted public praise, who wanted the sense of recognition, even if he created a shell that made it seem like he didn't want that. So there was this personal tension, and they were friends beyond their college years. So Russell would go and visit Wolpert all the time into the 1960s and into the early 70s before Wolpert passed away. But there was still the sense of sort of buried gripes that was very sort of a prevalent theme in Russell's early professional, in his college career and his early professional career. Those who knew him with the Celtics or at USF, in the interviews that I did, most of them were shocked that Russell could remember a lot of these details and a lot of these slights. They didn't come up during that time. He stored them, he saved them, and then he brought them out later in the mid-1960s when he really started to talk about the racism that sport reflected, as he saw it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, he seems like a very conflicted character, and therefore all the more fascinating, because he really mm-hmm. does hold these resentments for a long time, and he will occasionally say, as you point out in the book, something that really is quite hurtful about people whom he, I think, really loves. I can't, but he'll say these things that you're just like, whoa, that, where did that come from? And I think this happens throughout his life, where he's just kind of he's in conflict with himself about the way he feels about certain people. But let's go on to his pro career. Was it common for black athletes at the time to go on to pro careers in basketball?
Yes and no, mostly no. There were African Americans in the NBA since 1950. Each team, with the exception of the St. Louis Hawks, had a black player by the time Russell came to the NBA. Although when Russell joined the Celtics in 1956, he was the only African American on the Celtics at the time, though the Celtics had black players beforehand. I believe that 15 blacks played in the NBA in Russell's rookie season. This is when there was an 8-team league, so it was relatively small. So African Americans were playing in the NBA by the time Russell came. What made Russell distinctive was that he was the first African American star. As I write in the book, Russell didn't desegregate the NBA, but in some ways he integrated it. He was, in that sense, he was the Jackie Robinson of basketball, the first real star, the first player to drive his team to a championship, the first to generate so much publicity, the first to be associated with his team in the public realm on a higher level black role players who had preceded him in the NBA. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So, and he, what kind of relationship did he have with Red Auerbach? And can you tell us a little bit about Red Auerbach? At the...
Sure. Auerbach is a fascinating character in his own right, of course, and probably the greatest coach in NBA history. He's a guy who is consumed by basketball, consumed by winning, like Russell. And this is sort of where they find an alliance, in the sense that they will both sort of know what it takes to win and want to do whatever it takes to help the team win. And Auerbach has this reputation as something of a dictator or an autocrat. But in actuality, he was a guy who sought players who were intelligent and self-driven, and catered his approach to those players and really listened to them. It wasn't uncommon for him in a player huddle to ask the team what he thought they should do next, and then to make a final decision based on the input that he got from players. So in many ways, he was the most democratic of coaches. Mm-hmm. And he had a very interesting relationship with Russell. As you might know, Russell recently published a book called Red and Me, which was a memoir of his relationship with Red Auerbach. Mm-hmm. And it's basically a story of their friendship. But it's ironic that in the mid-60s, when Russell published his first memoir, which was a book called Glut for Glory, there's a line in it about him and Red Auerbach, which says, "We are not particularly friends." And then, 30, 40 years later, he's writing a book that says, that's about their friendship. So it was always a professional relationship and a friendship, and going back and forth on those two things. They often had areas of disagreement. One of them, from Russell's perspective, was that Auerbach was, while he was very open to signing and playing and using black players, was a little bit insensitive on issues such as segregation. For instance, in the Celtics in 1958, were on a tour, before a preseason tour, and were playing in Charlotte, North Carolina, and the black players were told that they had to stay at a separate hotel. And they didn't notice until they got to Charlotte. And Auerbach tried to talk to him about it and said, "I understand. I'm sorry about this. It won't happen again. But we got to play this game. And I understand. I'm Jewish, so I understand prejudice." And Russell says, "Oh yeah? Well, what hotel are you staying in?"
Yeah. Ouch.
So that was the kind of incident that really would sort of reveal both, how they're shared ideas and their commitment to winning, but at the same time, how they each forced the other one to evolve. Yeah. They were two strong-willed characters who really came to understand each other. And really, by the end of Russell's playing career, when he was the player coach at the Celtics in the late 60s, that's really when their friendship really flourished, because Russell so appreciated the way that Auerbach would really let him make his own mistakes and not impede. And that was somewhat surprising.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. They aren't, I don't know how to put this diplomatically, but neither one of them is exactly a nice guy, if you know what I mean. I mean,
that's absolutely true. Yeah, neither is warm and fuzzy.
No, yeah. No, neither one of them is warm and fuzzy, and I can only imagine that they generated a lot of heat and perhaps some light together. But let's talk about those early Celtics teams. How dominant was Russell in the late 50s and early 60s?
I think he was dominant, especially in the sense that people were unprepared for what Russell brought to the program. And even when he first arrived in the NBA, most people had never seen him play. And that speaks to the era. Because he was playing on the West Coast, and because the East Coast was the media center, and New York was the center of basketball, and the USF had only played there once, a lot of people had never seen him play. Most college basketball games were not televised nationally. Or a few college basketball games were televised nationally. So people kind of didn't know what to expect. And there's sort of one in particular individual story that sort of captures Russell's larger impact. There's a guy who played for the Philadelphia Warriors named Neil Johnston, who was a center. Three times he led the NBA in scoring. And he was a short guy for a center. He was 6 feet, 8 inches tall. And he had this sort of flat running hook that he would drive into the lane and shoot this little flip shot, if you will. And no one could really block it because he got it off quickly, and people didn't really leap to block shots. But Russell, every time he played against Johnston, would just dominate him because Russell later said that he could block 9 out of every 10 of Johnston's shots. He finally started letting him take it every once in a while just so he could block it when he really needed to block it. The first time they played against each other, Johnston didn't score for the first 42 minutes of the game. This guy was one of the leading scorers in the NBA. The second time they played, he didn't score for the entire first half. So Russell completely dominated him. And in a lot of ways, that was sort of the generational sea change that was going on. A guy like Johnson could dominate in the early and mid-50s. Once the Russell Revolution begins, he's kind of rendered obsolete within a few years. So that really speaks to Russell's impact, and just in terms of how he's shaping NBA defense and how he's shaping the game as a whole, because all of a sudden, you can't take that little flip shot. It makes the layup harder. It means you have to shoot from further out. You have to be faster and more athletic if you want to survive in the NBA. So it ironically makes offense in the NBA more dynamic and more creative to deal with these defensive innovations. As for the Celtics, what Russell provides for his team is their missing puzzle piece. The Celtics already had a reputation as sort of a run-and-gun, fast-paced, offensively gifted team, and that was really centered upon two players. One was Bob Cousy, who was one of the stars of the NBA, a very crafty and spectacular point guard, and the other was Bill Sharman, who was probably the NBA's best shooter, his shooting guard. And they played a very fast-paced style. And really what they were missing was someone who could get rebounds and who could play defense the way that Russell did. Once they had Russell, they were a juggernaut. They won the NBA title in Russell's rookie season. They only lost it in the second season because Russell sprained his ankle during the NBA Finals. And by his third year, they're beginning a streak of 8 consecutive titles. In Russell's 13th season in the NBA, his team won the NBA championship 11 of those times.
So Russell becomes very famous. How does he handle it?
At first, he's very, as he's becoming more, as his notoriety is increasing, he's very sensitive, again, to this idea of image politics, of being an ambassador of his race, of making sure that he projects himself as humble and selfless and praising his teammates and not causing a stir, if you will. By the early 1960s, by 1963, 1964 especially, the civil rights movement is starting to spur in him a sense of sort of a personal crisis. He's asking sort of what it all means. What's the point of being a sports celebrity? On the court, people cheer him and they celebrate him. Off the court, he's just another black person in a racist society. And he sees the sacrifices of civil rights activists, and he wonders, well, what am I doing to help this cause? And so, especially in this period from about 63 to 65, he's undergoing this time of turmoil, and it's shaping his personal life as well. His marriage is starting to fall apart. He's starting to engage in extramarital affairs in ways that he hadn't before. And he is withdrawing into himself. He's creating sort of a show, especially in public. It's at this point that he starts to refuse to sign autographs because he sees them as just sort of an empty display of celebrity worship, and he wants to be considered as an individual, not as just as a commodity. And he also starts to speak in public in ways that no black athlete had ever really done before, in which he's talking about the racism that exists within sport and within society. Just to give you some examples, he starts to defend Malcolm X and the Nation of Islam at a time when few black public figures would do so. He questions the strategy of nonviolence. He calls it, he says something like, this is a passive kick, and what if it doesn't work? If that doesn't work, Martin Luther King has failed as a leader. This was really something that no black athlete had ever said prior to this time. He accuses the NBA of having a quota system, that each team has only 4 or 5 blacks on its roster. And at the end of the bench, they never have black players because they only want blacks who are going to be stars. If it's on the end of the match, they're always going to fill out their roster with white players. And this causes a firestorm in the NBA. So in all these different ways, he's starting to challenge the orthodoxy. He's starting to challenge what accepted behavior for black athletes, if you will. And it's spawned by this sense of personal crisis.
Mm-hmm. He seems like the kind of person who loves to make life difficult for himself. I mean, he really sort of fouls his own nest, especially in Boston, which is I lived in Boston for quite a while, and I can tell you that the taint of racism is not gone from that place. And I can only imagine what it was like in the '60s. And he says some rather impolitic things about the fans and the people who run the organization, and he suffered for it. Yeah, I mean, I reading your book. Well, maybe I'll ask you to talk about it. He doesn't seem to have been really very well loved by the sports establishment in Boston.
It's interesting. The season ticket holders and those who were close to the Celtics loved Russell. They appreciated him, and many of them knew him as a person and very much appreciated him. Those who were very close on sort of the day-to-day scene with the Celtics. But that was a very small segment of Boston sports culture, because the Celtics weren't they weren't ingrained in the sports fabric of New England in the same way. It's a, as you know from living in Boston, it's a baseball town and it's a hockey town.
Yeah, that's right.
And the Celtics drew under 10,000 people for most of Russell's years. They wouldn't fill up the Boston Garden until, not even sometimes in the early rounds of the playoffs, not until they were really threatening to win the championship or threatening to lose the championship. Only in those last crucial games would you tend to see the Garden fill up. So it took a really long time for basketball to become associated with the city in a way that was very different from a city such as St. Louis or in Indiana or in New York. You know, the Knicks were a terrible team in the 60s, but had a very loyal fan base because basketball and New York were entwined with each other. The other aspect of Russell in Boston is that he became very active in the city's own civil rights movement, and helped to bring attention to the fact of racial injustice outside the South, in a very prominent and public way. In Boston, the battleground in the 60s, especially over schools, the schools aren't technically segregated, but they are de facto segregated. And this is what the NAACP in Boston is challenging. Russell goes to the school board meetings. He speaks about it to national publications such as Sports Illustrated and the Saturday Evening Post. He becomes Boston's most visible critic on the issue of race in a nationwide form.
Yeah. And then sort of later in his career, he becomes, and you know, I'd forgotten this entirely, he becomes a player coach. What exactly does that mean? Do we have those anymore? Are they? No, I don't really follow the NBA closely, but I don't remember any recent player coaches.
I can't remember who the last player coach was. I want to say it was Lenny Wilkins in the 1970s, and I could be wrong about that.
It sounds like a very 60s thing, you know, like kind of communal management or something. I don't, you know, again, please talk a little bit about player coaches.
Sure. There had been, in the 60s, there are two examples that I can remember. There had been a couple of player coaches before Russell, but it was rare. On the other hand, it wasn't like a modern NBA team now has, you know, practically a coach for every player. There's five or six guys at the end of the bench, at least. At the time, you know, every NBA team had a coach and a trainer, and that was it. So in 1966, Auerbach is ready to retire from being the coach. He's also the general manager of the team, and he's exhausted. And so he withdraws from day-to-day coaching to become the general manager, and he's looking for a coach. And he tries to get some of the Celtics who had since retired to take over behind the bench, Bob Cousy, Tom Hines, and some others, and they all declined for various reasons. They all had various commitments. So he starts to look outside the team, but he also gauges Russell's interest, because at this point, Russell is a 10-year veteran in the NBA, and he knows that whoever he gets for coach has to be someone who is going to motivate Russell. At this stage in Russell's career, he's barely practicing. He gives so much of his energy during games, and he hates practice. He doesn't. He kind of sees it as pointless. He knows whoever he gets as coach has to build a strong personal relationship with Russell. The Auerbach-Russell dynamic had been the strength of the Celtics for so long. And as that season goes on and goes into the playoffs in 1966, Auerbach. And both Russell reconsiders his originally he decided he didn't want the position, and then ultimately takes it, realizing that it gives a couple opportunities. It gives him a chance to take on a new challenge and perhaps revive his career to keep him motivated with another challenge. And it also gives him a chance to keep the Celtics coach within the Celtics fraternity. That was a team that was very conscious of seeing itself as a family, as a group of loyal alumni and the people who associated with the team very closely. There was only one major trade that Auerbach pulled off during Russell's time. So this was a team that stayed very consistent in terms of its personnel. And finally, Russell wanted, whether he acknowledged it or not, had an opportunity to become the first head coach, African-American head coach of any major professional team sport. So he's very much a barrier breaker in this regard as well. So when he started as a player coach in 67, he kind of ran it the way that maybe you played in a basketball league where you had a guy who was the team captain and basically put out the lineup and you know, made adjustments as it was going on, but was also playing at the same time. And Russell played most of the game and got help from his teammates. So especially by his second year, after Russell realized that he couldn't do it by himself in his first year, he really started to rely on this core of veteran teammates to help him with the substitutions, to help him with the strategy. That he kind of ran the team. He was the coach, and certainly he had the ultimate authority, but at the same time, it was kind of run in a very democratic way, which is pretty extraordinary to think about it, that this level of basketball, this was a group of teammates who were more or less policing themselves. Mm-hmm. And it worked. I mean, in Russell's first season as player coach, 1966-67, they did not win the NBA title for the first time in 8 years. But in his last two seasons, both times quite improbably, they won the NBA championship.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about a person who is really Russell's foil in life and in the book, and that is Wilt the Stilt Chamberlain. Being from Kansas, I have great love for Wilt Chamberlain, so I can think nothing bad about him. But why don't you talk a little bit about Chamberlain? Because he really is kind of the, in many ways, he's not the anti-Russell, but he's quite different than Russell.
Yeah, and maybe the anti-Russellist is too much, but they were certainly, as you mentioned, foils to each other. I mean, where Russell was the ultimate team player and who focused on defense and rebounding, Chamberlain was the ultimate individualist whose offensive statistics were just simply mind-blowing. This guy was a guy who was well over 7 feet tall, strong as an ox, and if Russell was a coordinated tall man, Chamberlain was that times three. He was, you know, and you could make a case that had he entered into an individual sport, we would consider him the greatest individual athlete of all time. There's never been anyone, I don't think ever, who had his combination of size, speed, strength, coordination. Here's a guy who in his rookie season is averaging 38 points and 28 rebounds a game. And by his third season, is averaging 50 points a game. And it's in his third season that he scores legendarily 100 points in one game. There's never been an offensive talent or a basketball talent like Wilt Chamberlain. What Chamberlain does for Russell is a few things. One is that he in some ways elevates Russell in the public eye. All of a sudden, Russell in his early years had been somewhat unappreciated in the public realm. By the early to mid-1960s, when Chamberlain enters the NBA, the Russell-Chamberlain dynamic, their rivalry, becomes the central narrative over the course of the 1960s in the NBA. They compel so much fascination because Russell has this reputation as a defensive wizard. Chamberlain is an unstoppable force on offense. How is that going to work? And their games often showcase Chamberlain's incredible offensive skills. It's not like Russell necessarily slows them down most of the time, but the Celtics keep winning title after title. So Russell's reputation soars because he's seen as, in some ways, negating the threat of Wilt Chamberlain. At the same time, the way that they handle themselves in public and the way that they project who they are to in the public is very different. Chamberlain always sees himself as a commodity, always sees himself as a great basketball player because there's been attention on him as a superstar in basketball since he was in eighth grade growing up in Philadelphia. And there's the sense of, you know, the commercialism of sport that infects Chamberlain from even when he's in high school. When he goes to Kansas to go play college basketball, people assume that he's getting some kind of deal, some kind of under-the-table payment, that it's the first national recruiting campaign for a basketball player really ever. And it's his recruiting campaign is the subject of a media frenzy. So, and Chamberlain, when he becomes a professional, does things like he says he's going to retire after his rookie season just as a way to get a new contract. He cuts an R&B single. He appears on TV all over the place. He issues outlandish pronouncements knowing that it will get him media attention, that will keep his name in the papers, and will make him rich. But he also, by the mid-60s, is starting to acquire another reputation, is that of if Russell is the ultimate winner, that he's the ultimate loser, the guy who can never elevate his team. You know, he forces his team to adapt to him rather than adapting to his team.
Yeah.
And because they lose so many close games to the Celtics and so many disappointments for his Philadelphia teams, and then later he plays for the San Francisco Warriors, he starts to acquire this reputation as the guy who can't win it all. And through the mid-60s, it's very frustrating to him. And it starts to seep into how he thinks about it and how the public thinks about him. He says in one article that he wrote for Sports Illustrated, and I'm paraphrasing here, but you know, after a while, defeat and victory smell the same in a professional basketball locker room. That you know, winning doesn't mean the same to him that it means to Bill Russell or to the other Boston Celtics. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it seems to me from a reading of your book that the best thing that ever happened to Bill Russell's image was, in fact, Wilt Chamberlain, because Russell was a very complicated guy, and I think on his own. You know, it's difficult to actually assess him, you know, if he's a, you know, a general force for good. I mean, really a complicated person, but Chamberlain was such a whiner. That's it. You know, really, just such a whiner that he as great as he was, it just makes Bill Russell look like you know, kind of a choir boy compared to. But let's actually talk a little bit about the choir boy thing, because I think if I could just say something, it may sound a little bit critical, but I don't mean it to be. I think you kind of let Russell off the hook for his personal life, because if I read it correctly, he basically abandoned his family.
Yes and no. Yes, he abandoned his family over the short term. He treated his wife terribly. He engaged in extramarital affairs, which in his second memoir, Russell talks about quite frankly. And when he, after his playing career is done, he moves to Los Angeles by himself and leaves his family behind. But then as his divorce is becoming final, after he's gone to Los Angeles, it forces him to become a more active parent in a way that he never had to be when he was actually living with his kids. So his kids would come out in the summer, and ultimately his daughter ends up staying with him and one of his sons for quite some time. So in the 70s, after his playing career is done, he ironically becomes a better parent after this, basically leaving them behind, originally when he moved to Los Angeles and then later to Seattle. It's a complicated relationship. His daughter is extremely loyal to him and only says nice things about him. His sons are more silent on the topic, so I don't know to what extent. It's difficult to say, I guess, in that regard, what their relationship is.
I mean, did he have any – at one point I remember the phrase in the book, you say that he grew tired of traditional marriage, if I may not be the exact quote.
Right.
But was it really so calculated, or did he just want to go cat around?
I mean, I don't know that it was I don't think it was calculated.
Did he really think about it so
yes,
much?
Yes, he did want to be. Yes, he did want a tomcat. I hope that I'm not letting him off the hook in that regard. I think I will. At one point, his personal life was filled with selfish ambivalence.
Yeah,
so I don't think that I'm.
No, that's right. No, that's right.
And anyone trying to excuse his behavior, but I'm trying to explain his behavior at the same time.
Yeah.
Trying to understand. And that's kind of how he rationalizes it to a certain extent too. He says that, you know, no two people can stay married for a long period of time. But that's really
right.
You know, his way of not willing to sacrifice his personal impulses. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Then, you know, after he retires, he has this period where he kind of he attempts to, and successfully, I guess I would say, become a public intellectual. What does he do?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's kind of fascinating, especially in the early 70s, after he retires from the NBA and he moves to Los Angeles. He tries to get into acting, but really he becomes, in a lot of ways, this symbol of integrity. Because in the sports world, by the early 70s, there's this disillusion going on with sport. There's the social protests that are coming out of the revolt of the black athlete. There is someone like Joe Namath or Will Chamberlain who are basically just sort of media puffed celebrities. And Russell, because he's been such a complicated individual, because he's been such an ultimate winner, and because he's a guy who has a reputation for always speaking his mind and never checking back on that, becomes the symbol of sort of, you know, that whatever's coming out of Russell's mouth is what he believes in. I have a quote from an executive of AT&T. He works as a spokesman for AT&T. He says about Russell, he's a strange guy. He doesn't say anything unless he believes it. and in the plastic age of the 1970s, maybe that is strange, I guess.
Yeah.
But it's sort of what explains Russell's sort of interesting notoriety in the mid-70s. And he kind of gets comfortable with being a public figure in a way that he never was as a sports celebrity, because it's on his own terms. And that's kind of ironic that he kind of dives into celebrity culture and exploits it for what it's worth in a way that he never did as an athlete. And here's where he owes Chamberlain. I mean, Chamberlain paved the way for him to do this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He makes it acceptable for a basketball star to do something like this.
Well, and so he has a lot of different gigs in the 70s and the 80s and into the 90s. He writes a column, is that right?
Yeah, he writes a column for the Seattle Times after he coached the Seattle Sonics from 73 to 77. And after he gets fired from his coaching responsibilities, he starts to write a column for the Seattle Times almost every Sunday. And the interesting thing about that column is it almost never has anything to do with basketball. He writes about everything under the sun, about the military, about politics, about homosexuality, about you name the issue, he engages in it one way or the other. He does interviews with people. he's just, you know, sort of writing as a curious individual and as a public intellectual. Mm-hmm. He penned his second memoir. He does it with Taylor Branch, who's now known for he wrote the America and the King series, a three-volume history of the Civil Rights Movement through Martin Luther King. This book is called Second Wind. It is probably the best memoir by an athlete that exists. It's the maybe the best book that I've ever written on, that I've ever read on sports. It's really a poetically done, very insightful book. He appears all over television. He goes on the talk show circuit. He really becomes a public intellectual, as you say. Yeah.
And he kind of softens his hard edge. He comes to be a kind of, the kind of wizened old man of basketball. He gets gray and he issues pronouncements. But they're never very angry anymore.
Especially by the turn of the century. There's so much, you know, and a lot of this is because, you know, for someone like of our generation, Larry Bird and Magic Johnson are the, you know, were the NBA's history, right? So we think of the NBA as this massive commercial endeavor that's full of money. But in Russell's age, that wasn't the case. And by the 1990s, especially with the turn of the century, Russell's realizing that, you know, he can harness this for his own ends. And because of his reputation, really what he starts to mute is his reputation as a critic, as a public scourge, if you will. And what he really starts to elevate is his reputation as a great winner. And that is how he markets himself, and that is how the team around him markets him. He writes it, you know, rather than writing these very introspective or political memoirs like his first two, he writes a third memoir called Russell Rules, which is a handbook for leadership that's designed to be used in corporate settings, and it's designed to take his basketball anecdotes and apply them into the corporate world. Mm-hmm. And he gets these gigs where he gets $10,000, $15,000 a pop to go speak to some boardroom. He really starts to consciously market himself as a commodity in a way that he'd for so long he'd resisted. But I mean, who can blame him?
Yeah,
there's
right,
a lot of money to be made on on telling you the story of your life, right?
Sorry. And quite an amazing life it was, actually, a totally amazing life.
Yeah.
So what is Mr. Russell up to today?
He has retreated from the public eye in the last few years. Sadly, he had a longtime companion, a woman named Marilyn Knowles, who he had met in the early 90s, and she just recently passed away. Mm-hmm. And apparently, that very much shattered me. She delivered him a lot of peace that existed in his life, and he finally felt sort of relaxed, you know, on a personal level, I guess, in terms of his relationships that didn't exist prior to that. And when she passed away in particular, Russell was starting to retreat a little bit from some of the public activities that he engaged in. But he's still sort of a spokesman for the NBA. Now NBA Finals MVP wins the Bill Russell Trophy, so you might have noticed that Russell is on hand anytime a team has a chance of clinching the NBA championship now to deliver the trophy himself. And he continues to do corporate gigs and things like that. So
did he
hasn't disappeared from the public eye.
I was going to say, did he have anything to say?
I should also say that he is very active in the initiative of mentoring. He works with the National Mentoring Partnership.
Oh, I see.
And that's his sort of pet cause.
Did he have anything to say about the election of Barack Obama? You know?
It's interesting that he came up a little bit because I know there was an NPR report, and I want to say there was an article as well that I also read about that he provided one of these early models of black leadership at a time when a few African Americans had a position of leadership over an integrated aspect of the United States. Mm-hmm. So it popped up a little bit, and also because Obama is a basketball fan. I know that Russell recently was, was part of the big group of NBA stars who had gone to the White House to play on Obama's birthday.
I can't resist saying this again. I probably said it 100 times on this show, but I used to play basketball with Barack Obama. I did. That's
all right.
I did. Yeah, I did. I did. Yeah, yeah. And I've never
met Bill. Barry the Bomber.
I've never met Bill Russell. So Barack's got one over on me. Let me ask you what I think is kind of a fitting end to our discussion of the book, and that is just simply this. And I played basketball for a long time, and I really was almost addicted to it. And after I'd retired, and that was just a few years ago, I really wondered whether I ever liked it. Did Bill Russell like to play basketball?
Bill Russell liked what he got out of basketball. After he retired from the NBA, As far as I know, he has never again played in an organized 5-on-5 game of basketball in his life.
Here, if I could just stop you right there for a second, because in stark contrast, take someone like Larry Bird, who built the gymnasium at his home, or someone like Magic Johnson, who still plays. He still has this pickup game that's legendary in Los Angeles. So Russell threw it off, huh? Go ahead, keep talking about Russell and his ambivalence about it.
For Russell, basketball was a means to an end. He liked the rewards of basketball. And I don't simply mean the material rewards. I mean that he loved winning. He loved cooperation. He loved to work with his team. But he hated practice even when he was in the NBA. He really concentrated all of his energies on games. If it wasn't about the competition, if it wasn't about the winning, then basketball didn't mean anything to him. Basketball was only important as a vehicle for victory. And that was sort of how he proved himself. The basketball brought him the recognition, the sense of self-worth, the sense of pride, the sense of accomplishment, that as a kid, when he was poor and his mom was dead and he was a gawky teenager, that didn't exist. So basketball gave him a vehicle into a way of life, a way of thinking about himself and his world that was only valuable insofar as what victory brought him.
I mean, he says, I think you quote this, I can't remember exactly, but he says, I don't want to be known as a basketball player. I want to be known as a person who plays basketball. Is that right? Or a man who plays basketball? I think he uses the word man.
He often uses, I mean, manhood and the word man comes up again and again in my book, because that is sort of central to how he thinks of himself. He always says, and on his tombstone, he writes in Go for Glory, he says, let it be, and he just wants his epitaph to read, here lies Bill Russell, a man, that he wants to be considered as an individual, as a human being. And that includes, you know, the complexities of a human being. That includes the frailties. He's not concerned with puffing himself up in terms of an image. Rather, he wants to be considered as an angel. That's why he doesn't sign autographs. That's why he didn't want to be inducted into the Hall of Fame. He was trying to challenge how people thought of him and how people thought of celebrities in sports, but he wanted to be considered as an individual instead.
This may sound ridiculous, but he reminds me a little bit of Marlon Brando, who really loved, you know, he was a great actor. I don't think he liked acting, but he certainly had a very conflicted relationship with the public. And I think Russell is very ambivalent about the whole thing. Does Russell have anything to say about the kind of emergence of bad boys in the NBA in the last 15 or 20 years? There have been a lot of them, and they've acted very badly. Does he ever sort of...
He's been very careful, I would say, not to be critical of any contemporary athletes. And I don't think that's because he's trying to protect them. I think it's because he wants people considered as individuals. He's not willing to make some type of generalization about, oh, the players in the NBA are like this now, whether they're thuggish or criminals or whatever. He doesn't want to engage in that discourse. That he wants to be very careful about saying, hey, people want to... And when people were saying, oh, shouldn't someone like Michael Jordan, shouldn't he get involved in politics in the way that you did and help the other African-Americans? He said, hey, Michael Jordan makes his choices as an individual. It's not my position to tell him what to do. He's very careful about how he thinks, about how he was, how he portrayed that.
I think after listening to you talk so eloquently about him, I think I've concluded that Bill Russell's epitaph should be Bill Russell, hard to like but easy to respect.
True. And Russell, I mean, and he would like that. He doesn't care if you like him. What he cares about is if you respect him. In that sense, because I came to respect him so much, I came to like him more than I think if I ever. And I've never met Bill Russell. He's a very private person, and although I talked to over 50 people, a lot of his close friends and teammates and relatives with this book, I never talked to Bill Russell. I never expected to from the beginning of the book, though I tried. And I feel like having not met him, I can just simply, in some ways it might be an advantage because now the respect is that I have for him filters through the book rather than any sort of sense of personal, well, he was a jerk to me, so I'm going to treat him poorly in this book.
Right. Well, I'll say this. God bless Bill Russell. That's I think, what I have to say about him. So we've taken up a lot of your time, Aram, and thank you very much for writing the book. It's terrific. Let me ask you our traditional final question on New Books in History, and that is, what are you working on now? What's your current project?
I'm trying something new. I am writing a more sort of traditional civil rights history. I'm writing a book about the Merritt March Against Fear, which was a civil rights march in 1966, of June of 1966. It started with one man. It started with James Meredith, who was famous for integrating Ole Miss in 1962. Mm-hmm. 4 years after that, he decides that he's going to launch what he calls his March Against Fear, in which he walks from Memphis, and the idea was to reach Jackson, Mississippi, about 220 miles to the south. And along the way, he was going to encourage people to register to vote, and he was going to conquer this notion of fear that was keeping so many black Mississippians from achieving their full due inequality. On the second day of Merritt's march, he gets shot. He survives, but once he's shot, it compels the major civil rights organizations to come to Memphis and to take up his march. And from there on, it becomes this fascinating 3 week story of registering voters, of conquering a lot of black Mississippian fears. There's all these local stories along the way to tell, and also these incredible personal and political dynamics of major civil rights organizations, Martin Luther King, Stokely Carmichael, Floyd McKissick, who's the head of CORE at the time. And this is at a time when SNCC and CORE are starting to adopt more of what we might call a black nationalist agenda. And the NAACP, Roy Wilkins, the head of the NAACP, decides that they will not participate in the march because he doesn't want it to be associated with this sort of unplanned, impromptu, three-week national demonstration that's dominating the headlines. And ultimately, what the March Against Fear is most known for is about midway through the march, Stokely Carmichael unveils the slogan of Black Power and questions about what does Black Power mean, what's the context. Inspiring all these questions and debates about black politics in the white liberal press among African Americans themselves. And that means something very different on a national scale. That means on a local scale. It's really just, I'm trying to do this sort of narrative history that can sweep in a lot of the new scholarship that's been done on the civil rights movement in terms of all these incredible stories of local movements and local politics and connect that to these to this national agenda. So I hope I can pull it off. It's a great story. I hope I'm equal to the task.
I'm sure that you are. If this book is any indication, you certainly are equal to the task. I should tell our listeners that we've been talking to Aram Gudsousian about his book, King of the Court, Bill Russell and the Basketball Revolution. Aram, I want to say thank you very much for spending this hour with us. I really appreciated the book, and I appreciated talking to you.
Thanks, Marshall. I appreciate it very much.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to an interview with Aram Gudsousian about his book, King of the Court, Bill Russell, and the Basketball Revolution. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in History. I hope you have a great week.